Accession number 12149, Reel 7.
Captain Sutton, Reel 7.
The Germans had invaded Greece at the beginning of April and had swept down the east coastal plain. This had, I watched this on maps and heard the reports, and I got a vivid impression of a massive armored advance with a very closely integrated German air force, knocking the British out, cutting off the Greeks so that they surrendered, the British making stands at various places like Thermopylae, and then when there became only the airfields around Athens left in the hands of the British and Greeks, the situation became absolutely untenable. With the arrival of the British Expeditionary Force under Sir Henry Maitland Wilson, there had also arrived a British admiral in charge of the Piraeus, I think he was called the Flag Officer Athens, I'm not quite certain, his title, Bailey Groman. I first reported to him wanting some assistance, and he straight away tried to appropriate me to his staff. And then when he heard that I was on the staff of the Air Officer Commanding, he said, well, I can't have you in that case, it's impossible. I've already said that we've pulled back from Parabathia. At the same time, the next thing was to try and withdraw from Greece, because we had finished the Second Moon Period operations, we can no longer operate against the Italians, and we wanted to get the aircraft and the aircrew out. I went to Billy Groman, who said that General Maitland Wilson had ordered a standstill of all British forces and that no British forces were to withdraw. But of course, there's a way around everything. I got the aircraft to fly out down to Malmö, because this was part of their ordinary procedure. And this was one of my most anxious moments of my life. The day that the last of the swordfish flew away, carrying mines from Elefsis down to Malmö, was the day that the Germans developed their very heavy air attacks on the airfields round Athens. These were the two main ones, anyway, it were Lefsis and Menili. A swarm of ME-109s came in over the rooftops of Athens, and as they came in, I saw the swordfish going out underneath them, the opposite direction, going down to Crete. And of course, although the mines weren't primed, it would have been a very nasty mess if one of those aircraft had been brought down in Athens. Anyhow, they got away, but I was left with the air crew, the ground crews. Bailey Groman, I then saw again, and I explained to him that we had a squadron down in Crete, but no ground crews to service them. Ground crews were stuck in Greece. Therefore, we had a completely inoperative squadron, which was going to just sit. And he took the point and went and saw the general, who gave permission for the ground crews of 815 to leave as an exception to his general rule of a standstill. I was told that if I could get them out, I could. I saw the naval officer in charge of the Piraeus, the Greek harbour for Athens, who said that there was a merchant ship, British merchant ship out there, that was going to be calling in at Souda Bay in Crete, and that if I could persuade him to take my personnel, then that'd be fine. But he couldn't know anything about it. He couldn't requisition it. So I went out, saw the master of the ship, who said certainly he'd take them. He couldn't provide them accommodation, and he couldn't provide them with food. He'd give them water. I said, doesn't matter, fine, they'll bring their rations. Most of them have sleeping bags, and they can doss down on deck. And so I got 815 Squadron on board a merchant ship, and they were taken down to Crete, disembarked at Souda Bay. That got them out. So in actual fact, my job as operating 815 Squadron from Greece therefore finished, I can't remember the date, but about a week before Athens fell. Well, the next thing that I did, really, was that the whole of the Air Force was being shot out of the sky, and I was called in as a duty operations officer in the Air Force headquarters, while all their pilots were out at the airfields trying to fly anything that was left flyable. So for a day or two, I acted as a duty RAF operations officer in the RAF headquarters. And then a group of about a dozen Yugoslav seaplanes came down and put down in Athens in Scaramanga Bay, the bay just to the west of Athens, there was a discussion as to what would be done to them, and I said I'd navigate them down if they wanted this, down into Souda Bay. This was agreed, and I had a talk with the Yugoslav Lieutenant Colonel in charge of the flight. Most of them were Dornier seaplanes. Of course, the Yugoslavs didn't make their own aircraft. They bought German, mostly German. One morning early, I took off as the observer in the squadron commander's aircraft to fly down to Souda Bay. Now, I had arranged with the naval officer in charge that a convoy which was leaving harbour that day would know that we were taking off, because the air corridor which we had to fly, which flew from Athens down to Medos, down to Crete, would cross over the route that the convoy would take. And I was anxious, of course, that flying down with German-type aircraft, that we wouldn't be fired on. But things were very hairy in those days. Anything that looked German was shot at. We took off in the early morning as the mist was rising, and no sooner we got above the mist than we were engaged by every gun in the convoy. I told my pilot in my bad French, which was the language we were conversing in, to land on the water again, and the whole dozen aircraft, I think 11 or 12 aircraft, landed down and we waited until the convoy had passed by and got out of it. So we were down in the mist, the convoy moving on down. We then took off again, and this time I didn't keep the corridor. I knew that we were going to get shot at again, so I took them right round the back of where the convoy was and down to Crete. Now, again, I had made arrangements that they knew precisely that we were coming in German-type aircraft because Ceuta Bay had been under considerable attack from the Germans by this stage. And they, again, were very trigger-happy. And I, at the entrance of Ceuta Bay, there was a point at the entrance of the harbour. And on this was a sort of old fort, and that was the signal station. It had been taken over by the Navy. And I circled this with my dozen aircraft in line astern after me, firing off the recognition signals of the day, until eventually I got a reply from the signal station telling me to proceed. So that was it. I cleared myself and I flew down into Ceuta Bay. They didn't stop the gunners firing at me. Again, every chap who saw a Dornier aircraft coming in to land let fly. We got down. We weren't shot down. One aircraft, in actual fact, was a little float plane, which I was told had been in the Schneider Trophy pre-war, an early Messerschmitt, I think it was. That beached itself. The rest of the planes managed to find buoys, tied themselves up, and then the RAF collected from all these and took them on board the crews on board a flying boat tender ship, which was lying in Ceuta Bay at that stage. I've got a name, begins with M, I think, Mandela, I can't remember. We had lunch on board, and I handed over the whole of this contingent to the RAF, which is the intention, and I then found a pilot who was going to fly back to Athens, an RAF pilot going to fly back in his Bombay transport aircraft back to Athens, and begged a lift off him to get back to my job in Greece. He said, yes, provided I manned one of the rear guns. Well, I was only too delighted to man a rear gun. I didn't want to sit in an aircraft where the sky is full of German fighters and just wait to be shot at. Much better to have a gun and at least be able to shoot back. So I agreed, and his aircraft was at Malmö. We went out to Malmö, and we took off. Nobody else in the aircraft except for the crew. They'd brought out RAF air crew and ground crew. We put down at Menidi. There were a lot of aircraft in the air when we were going in. And as we landed in the latest afternoon, there were RAF chaps on the ground gesticulating wildly and pointing, and we waved back, and then they pointed, and we looked, and there was a swarm of ME-109s coming in to attack the airfield, about, I think, 30, 40 aircraft, spread right out round, and we dived for cover everywhere where there was an aircraft standing. I think there was always a slip trench in those days. One dived for cover as the aircraft we just arrived in went up in a sheet of flame from the German fighters. I got a lift into Athens and reported to the senior air staff officer, group captain, who said, Christ, you back? I thought we got rid of you. Didn't you fly down to Crete? I said, yes, sir, and I come back, but I'm still on your staff. Oh. And then there was a discussion, which I didn't take part in. I was then told that I was to report down to Scaramanga Flying Boat Base that night at, I think it was 11 or 12 o'clock, late at night. I went and had supper with some friends in the town. It was the most eerie feeling in Athens. It was just before the Germans were going to take the town. There was a feeling of intense anticipation and certain amount of dread. The place was full of burning paper, showering down on the streets as everybody burnt their records. Anyhow, I reported down to Scaramanga, where there was a IF squadron commander, a squadron leader, who I knew, called Lynch, was in charge. He actually was a supply chap, but in those days, anybody was taking on any job. He was in charge of the flying boat operations. And when I reported to him, he said, "Oh, you're one of them, are you?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, don't you know you're detailed to your company, the Greek Royal Family?" Two flight lieutenants arrived and joined me. We three then stayed with Lynch, and the Greek Royal Family turned up to be evacuated by a flying boat. There was everybody except for the king. There was the king's brother Paul and his wife Frederica, and they later became king and queen of Greece when King George of Greece died. There was Princess Alexandra of Greece, who married King Peter of Yugoslavia, became queen of Yugoslavia. There was the two young children of Frederica, Sophia, who's now Queen of Greece, Queen of Spain, and Constantine, who is the later became King of Greece. There was the king's uncle, an admiral of the Greek Navy, man with magnificent long moustaches, almost a foot long either side of his face. There were the Aquarius and this, that, and the other. There was also the king's mistress, Mrs. Britton Jones. I didn't know at that time. I knew Mrs. Britton Jones. I'd heard vaguely of her, and so had everybody, because it had been very much in the news at the time that Edward VIII had gone down the Adriatic coast with Mrs. Simpson, and they had become all of a party, King George of Greece, Mrs. Britton Jones, our king, and Mrs. Simpson. Mrs. Britton Jones wasn't considered one of the Greek royal family, and whereas the whole of the Greek royal family and their entourage were in one cabin of the flying boat, we junior officers assigned to a company, Mrs. Britton Jones and another group of people who were also being evacuated were assigned to a separate cabin. Anyhow, we three assigned officers, two flight attendants and myself, spent about an hour ferrying off extremely heavy and very nice leather suitcases to the aircraft, and we reckon these must be the crown jewels. We were getting a bit anxious for time, because the previous day the Germans had attacked the flying boat base shortly after dawn and had knocked out a flying boat. And so we were terribly anxious to get off before first light. This happened, in natural fact. And we got down to Suda Bay. Now, this time, it was a British aircraft. They had been very well briefed, and there was no gunfire at all. It wasn't like my last flight down. And we put down in Suda Bay just as the sun was well, it wasn't light, but it was the grey light of the pre-dawn. You could see the water and everything else all right, but the sun wasn't over the mountains. And we went to a boy, a mooring boy there, tied up, and nothing happened. Sure enough, they'd been warned that we were coming. And so I asked the aircraft captain if I could signal for him, and so I signaled to the cruiser York. The cruiser York had been sunk by an Italian motor torpedo boat some months earlier. It was sitting on the bottom in Suda Bay with her upper decks and guns and things showing. It was, in actual fact, was a sort of bit of a static fort. She was still partly operational, but in actual fact would never go to sea again. I signaled to the York, in naval parlance, PSB VIPs, please send boat, very important persons, in semaphore. And I got back signal, MRU, much regret unable, have no boats. But they obviously got in touch with the RAF, because an RAF dinghy came off. An attendant dinghy for attending on flying boats came off and started to ferry the party ashore. They ferried the Greek royal family ashore, and there was a little jetty, wooden jetty there, and the party got bigger and bigger and just standing there. And so I said I'd better go ashore and take charge of them, because I knew where the geography of the place and where the naval officer in charge's offices and things were. So I went ashore next and took the whole of this party up to the offices of the naval officer in charge, which was a wooden a stone hut on the hillside above the waterfront there, and knocked on the door, went in, and there was a duty officer starting to lay out the charts on the table for morning operations. I said, "We've got the royal family outside." He said, "Oh, God's sake, don't try and be funny this time of the morning." I said, "I've got the Greek royal family outside." He said, "Oh, shut up." I said, "Come and look, I've got the Greek royal family outside." And he came to the door and he said, "Christ." And they were taken in, and they stripped the table of the charts. They brought benches out, arranged a breakfast table, brewed up coffee and toast and marmalade, and the whole of the party, the royals and the equerries and the nannies and everybody else, all sat round on benches round a bare wooden table and tucked into a thorough, gooey naval breakfast. And in the middle of this, we heard bump, 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 bump. And these were anti-aircraft guns firing. I went outside the door to see what was happening. And as I looked, there were JU-88s, I think they were, in glinting in the sun as they turned to dive. Now, by that time, the sun was over the mountains, but very low, and so an aircraft banking would show absolutely sort of silver up against the light. I saw the glint of the underneath the wings, and we rushed in and got the party out and went down to shelter trenches as bombs came down. They weren't actually attacking us. They were attacking ships in the harbour just below us, and they hit a tanker, and the we crowded into the trenches. I was with Princess Alexandra, who had little girl Sophia with her, I'm pretty certain, and they weren't going fast enough, so I grabbed Sophia and ran with her. And we crouched down, and there was the princess, a Greek shepherd boy who was also taking shelter, and the Greek admiral in his admiral's uniform, and myself and one or two others, all waiting until the attack was over. As I say, the bombs weren't actually on us. Once the raid was over, we got out of the trenches, and then things happened terribly quickly. A cavalcade of bloody great black Mercedes cars came along. This was the Greek governor and commander-in-chief who'd come to meet the royal family. They snatched them away from us and whisked them away. I rather felt the implication being that we'd endangered that royal family by holding them in a dangerous area. Anyhow, that was that. They took them away, and that's the last I saw of them for that moment, for that time. I have actually encountered one or two of them since, but that was it. So it was very early morning. I had been evacuated, and I then saw a tanker was settling in the water, a tanker that had been hit with the bombs. Naval officer in charge, Suda Bey, at that stage was a rather ancient lieutenant commander. So I went to him and said, anything I could do? And he said, well, see if you've got help there. I said, what do you want done? He said, well, if she's sinking, the Beecher, but if she's not sinking, then see if you can help the salvage. It sent out a harbour craft to her. I went out in a boat, went alongside this sort of tug alongside her, and discovered that it was the Chief Petty Officer Coxon, Naval Coxon, in command, whom I had known when I was in the Basilisk earlier. He had been one of my leading torpedo operators when I was the number two of the Basilisk in 1936 or so. And so Vassil and I had a quick talk on the situation, and he said he was waiting for orders to beach the ship, that the master was down inside the ship examining her to see what the damage was and whether she was salvageable. And so we waited a bit, and in due course the master came out, the master of the tanker, and we said, well, we got orders to beach her. If you've got to, he said, that's what I've been waiting for. I've been waiting for orders to beach her. So we, Vassil, chief of the officer, the master and I, studied the chart, and we decided that we'd better take this ship and put her on a sandy bottom in a cove where there were no rocks, and we could run her in there. We did this. I stood alongside my chief petty officer, and the master went on his bridge, and together with a few contradictory orders and this and the other, we managed to run her up on a beach. The place that we'd selected was one which I'd mainly been responsible for choosing, because I'd been in destroyers before and I knew that